Welcome to a panel discussion from the 2019 Traverse City Film Festival. On today's panel, Deep Doc Secrets, with documentary filmmakers from this year's festival. This event was recorded Thursday, August 1st, at the Traverse City Old Town Playhouse. Now here's your moderator, Michael Moore.
We make nonfiction, I believe, because we believe that there is a tremendous amount of power in telling people the truth. But we do live in a time where it seems the truth doesn't matter. And not just with the President of the United States. He didn't fall out of the sky. He came out of a culture and a climate of decades, centuries, of telling the big lie, whether it was how he treated our native people who were here before the white people, how this country was built on the backs of slaves, and everything that's been told since then. So I don't see Trump as a some weird anomaly. He's just the next progression of telling that long lie. So here we are, people who most, I would say, don't have comfortable means by which to just do whatever we want to do to try and get the word out there. But I have been lucky because people bought a lot of tickets to my first film, which then allowed me to make the other films with the freedom and not have to worry about the financial end of it. So I'm probably alone on this stage unless there is Rick with his trust fund, but I'm just kidding.
From Mansalona, Michigan.
Yes, from Mansalona, Michigan. So we are a part of a growing and very large group now of people who are using film, cinema, to tell these larger truths. And I'm very honored to have these eight with me here on the stage this morning. We have many others here this week. I hope you get a chance to see these documentaries. I'm going to have them each quickly introduce themselves to you and tell you what film they're here with and maybe what else they've done or whatever, where they're from, favorite color, whatever. But we'll whip through this pretty quickly so we can get right into the discussion. Rick Rowley.
I'm Rick Rowley. I'm here along with Jacqueline Suen, a producer who's out there in the dark somewhere, with the film 16 Shots, which is about the police killing and cover-up of the murder of Laquan McDonald in Chicago. Jackie and I have over 20 years made, you know, a dozen films, mostly inside of social movements. Well, initially inside of social movements that believed they were transforming the world. Then when the war started, we were war reporters for 10 years. Now we're trying to engage with what feel like the most important kind of reckonings that our culture is having. And that is, for us right now, feels like this reckoning around race and justice, this kind of blood knot of violence at the center of the American experience for 300 years.
And you were nominated for the Academy Awards for which film?
Oh, yeah, and I was nominated for an Academy Award for a film called Dirty Wars, which followed Jeremy Scahill, exploring the extremities of the global war on terror.
And when you say the war...
Yeah, so the...
So just because this war never ends, we know that that's what you mean, right?
Totally, yes, yeah. A war which continues today. So not just the battlefields that we know of in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we filmed in Yemen, Somalia, and the sort of the lesser-known fronts of this war that continues to this day across Africa, the Gulf, Syria, of course, and beyond.
Barrick?
Hi, thanks, Michael. Barrick Goodman. I'm lucky enough to be here with two films, Slay the Dragon, about gerrymandering and voter suppression, with my co-director, Chris Durrance, who is not here right now, but is here. And the second film is on Woodstock Music Festival. It's called Woodstock, 3 Days That Defined a Generation. So thank you for having me at the festival. I've been making films for forever. My wife, Rachel Dretson, and I started a company 30 years ago, 25 years ago. Mostly I do historical documentaries. I made a film on the Oklahoma City Massacre and on My Lai Massacre and on other massacres in American history. We have made films for Frontline for years, all sorts of things. It's a wonderful way to make a living. It's a great profession for a dilettante like myself. But increasingly, I'm intent on making films about the political situation we're in. So Slay the Dragon was the first, and I hope to follow it with other similar films. But again, thank you.
Yeah, thanks also. I would say I'm one of the few, like Michael, who was a working class filmmaker coming from a working class background, and I've never forgotten it, as you never have, that experience. I'm from Dayton, Ohio, and most of the work I've done is in and around Southwest Ohio, not all, but most. So here, there's a film that was filmed in 1970 when I was a college senior. It was my senior project. Called Growing Up Female, and then another called Seeing Red, Stories of American Communists, that came out in 1983-84. And then the new film, which is called American Factory, and it just came out this year, and it's filmed at an old General Motors plant that closed, as so many plants are doing, have done and are doing, in the Midwest, in the heartland, closed when the economy collapsed, which you all remember in 08, and was bought, to all of our shock, by a Chinese billionaire entrepreneur who reopened the plant and manufactures automotive glass. So that's American Factory, and that's playing here.
We also have, in the festival this week, a sidebar honoring Julia's films. All of us, we consider her one of the real movers and founders of the modern day documentary movement. She's been a documentary filmmaker for 50 plus years, and I personally have been inspired by you before I even thought of making documentaries, and it's a real honor to have you here.
Well,
from Dayton, Ohio.
And I would say I am
the Flint of Ohio.
It's so similar, yeah, really. I'm just very inspired by Michael, starting with Roger and me on up. I always say he was the punk rock kid who like busted open the documentary form. Wow. No longer a kid, but you know, yeah.
Stay with the kid part.
Yeah.
Joan Churchill.
Yeah. Well, I would say, along with Julia, that we're probably the OGs here. I've been making films for 50 years. I'm basically a cinematographer, so I believe very much in the crew being the filmmakers. So trying to keep everything as low-key, as tight and small as possible, so that, you know, maybe there's three people. Sometimes you start out with a third person, which is very handy as an assistant who gets the releases and drives the cars. And then that person leaves after 6 weeks because we can no longer afford to pay them. And then it's just the two of us. I do the shooting. I've worked a lot with Nick Broomfield. We've made over 10 films together. And then I got married to Alan Barker, who's another person who does sound. I always married my sound men. And it's, you know, I would say it is a great life. I hate being a tourist. I want to find out about people. And I think you have to have a genuine interest in people. I'm here with a film that I made 35 years ago with Nick Broomfield. It's just called Lily Tomlin. And thanks to Michael and to Tia Lesson, somewhere out there, the film has been digitally remastered, and I'm very excited to see it on the big screen again. I have not seen it.
Well, we're happy to do that. We've helped a number of films here, or the people who support this festival have helped restore films, obtain films, especially sometimes from countries that are at times more oppressive than ours. And so I'm glad you're here. I'm glad we're going to get a chance to see this. So thank you very much for being here and for all your years. So. Wad.
Good morning. I am... My name is Wad Al-Khatib. I'm a Syrian filmmaker. I'm here for a film called For Sama. with my fellow director, Edward Watts, and my husband, who's subject in the film too. The film speaks about 5 years of love, war in Syria, when we were there. And now we are refugee in London, in the UK. And we've been moving with the film since March, when we finished the film. The film, for me, is not just a film. It's my life. It's everything we went through in the most difficult and horror conflict around the world in the in this time. And I'm so proud that I could stand and make the story and share it around the world. I'm so happy that you are all like, it's 10 a.m. in the morning and all of you really here, and exciting to hear all this great story from other great directors. I'm so happy. Thank you so much for having us here.
Thank you for making a beautiful film. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Nanfu Wang. I'm originally from China. I came to the United States in 2011 with a scholarship to attend a graduate school. And that was the first time I saw documentaries, because I grew up in a poor village where TV was not available until I was 10, and documentaries were just not of media that we were allowed to see. So some of the first documentaries I saw were in 2011, and one of them was Sickle. And that was when I was like, oh, I never thought I wanted to make documentaries until I took a documentary class and felt really impacted myself by the films I saw. And I was thinking, remember, I want to go back to China to make a film about the healthcare there and how inadequate it was, because my father died when I was 12. And that was the first documentary idea, although it never happened. I did go back in 2013 and made my first film, which showed here in 2016, Hooligan Sparrow. Great. Yeah, thank you. And I'm here now with a film called One Child Nation. It's about the consequences of China's one-child policy. And I became a mother 2 years ago, so looking at the one-child policy through the new perspective of being a mom and looking beyond the propaganda of China's one-child policy and find out the truth, what really happened. And I wanted to apologize first because the film is showing now, so I might run to the Q&A in about like 10 or 15 minutes, leave the panel. So sorry about that.
Thank you for being here. Jeff Gibbs had his world premiere of Planet of the Humans last night at the State Theater. It was amazing response, and take it away.
Oh, we may be cute, we may be clever, but maybe we went a little too far, just a little bit, we humans, and that's kind of the story. And maybe it's a story reflecting it. Assuming that most people here believe in climate change and environmentalism and that we're in some trouble, that maybe we've taken some wrong turns as an environmental movement. And this is a long journey making this, because basically I made another film first. I thought if I made a film about the downfall of nature and all the ecological disasters, that would wake us up. And I think I learned that I too had to question my own assumptions about what was going to save us and what we all understood. And we've talked about this over the decades, and just, you know, the one thing I learned from you was that no matter what you think you've accomplished or finished or whatever, if it's not the right story and if it's not done, it's not done. And so I think I probably took another 10 years, 5 years, you know, to really spool this out and to come to grips with the movie we've really cemented the last couple of years that you see. So I'm from Flint, Michigan. I grew up just outside of Flint. We were too poor to live in Flint, so that's
I think people in Michigan know Beecher, right?
Beecher, what's that?
Beecher School District.
I grew up in Flint Beecher, yeah, and then I've lived in northern Michigan for 20 years, so happy to be here. And thank you for having the courage to show my film these other films. I mean, it's tremendously, I don't know if any of you have went through this, but sometimes if you have a story that's challenging what everyone believes, it's difficult to even get anybody to show that. You would think the film festivals would be all over that, but that can be difficult if it doesn't fit in somehow with what they're I'm sure they don't think that consciously, but you know, it's just been a very interesting process. So thank you for having the courage to do this festival and make it about documentaries.
Steve.
Hi, I'm the lucky to be the partner of that lady down there, Julia Reichert. We've been making films now together for 20 plus years. When we became a couple, we vowed never to co-direct because it would mean the end of our relationship. But then we learned how to do it, and as long as we're not drinking and talking about the film, it goes okay. Or in bed, we don't talk about the film in bed, whatever we're working on. It's just a good life advice. But it's an honor to be on this platform with these amazing colleagues. We have learned so much from Joan Churchill, Julia, and I, and from Alan Barker about camera work, sound work, being small and present in the room. It's just an honor to be on stage with you, Joan. So, and thank you, Michael, for showing this new film. We made American Factory. It was 3 years of insane production and then a year of intense editing, and we're lucky to be here.
Oh, thank you. It's American Factory, it's a beautiful, powerful look at where we're at right now, industrial America. And thank you for making it, and thank you for all the work that you've done. And we'll take the fact that you've sat on the opposite side of the stage is not an indication of how it worked out with the co-directing.
Yes, please.
Right. All right, so let's get going, and why don't I just throw something out? Many of you, most of you, have made films about something that's going on right now in the present, something that we're grappling with. We don't see a lot of these documentaries being distributed. The ones that do get good distribution involve, I found where my father lived and went and made a movie about him. Me and my other two brothers got separated at birth, or let's watch a guy climb a rock wall that happens to be a mountain and see if he dies, which is kind of like, if you like NASCAR, it's the same sort of thing when you're watching the movie, right? Because every minute you're thinking, oh, I don't want to watch this, please. Those are the movies that make it. We were talking yesterday's panel about the documentaries over the last couple of years, or a nostalgia film, history films, or something that wishes that Mr. Rogers was still alive, that makes us all long for a better time, or at least something that felt like a better time. That's not a criticism of those films. Those are wonderful movies. But the question I want to throw out here is, when you choose to make a film about something that's in the here and now, I think we were looking at the list of the, over the last 5 years, the documentaries that are shortlisted for the Oscars, that are voted on even by our own branch. Of the 15 films that are shortlisted, maybe two or three deal with a current American issue. Lots of films about how other countries, Americans going to other countries to show how they're messing things up. But very few that show what we do in the here and now and go at it with the camera and the microphone as a weapon for the people. That is rare. It's rare that it's recognized by our own fellow documentary filmmakers, and it's rare that it gets distribution or makes the kind of money I think it should make. So I throw that out to anybody who would like to respond to the fact that, and I think most people, those who have made a number of films, have also made the other films too, but it's when you choose to make this kind of film, I mean, the irony of just that you are here with this beautiful film about Woodstock, not the actual, the original Woodstock movie, but how Woodstock, and all this great new footage, and the film that you're here with also, Slay the Dragon, about how we passed a ballot proposal in Michigan last November to make it a crime to gerrymander and to set up a system to where this is going to hopefully end. So it's such a powerful film. So anybody here can start this discussion as to why you made this particular film that you've made and why every voice in your head was telling you don't do it, because no one's going to fund it, you're not going to make anything, no one's going to see it, and I'm not going to get an Oscar nomination.
Okay, I could start that.
Okay.
or unless you want to.
No, please.
Well, so, you know, we live in Dayton, Ohio, and I mentioned the GM plant closed, and it was closed for years, and then this Chinese billionaire opened it again. And we got the opportunity, I won't go into detail, to actually have access to film in that plant, and it ended up being for 3 years. So a couple things on that. One is, when we got access to everybody, the management, the owner, the workers on the floor. That was a first for us. You talked about the camera as a weapon, which that is kind of how I've seen it, except for this film.
Stunning access.
Amazing access. And when you get that kind of, I want to make one point, but then another. When you get that kind of access and you have the ability to talk with management about what they're going through, the difficulties they're facing, why they don't want a union in there, why they hate the idea there's a union battle. You talk to the owner and you talk to him about the American workers, they just can't deliver. And you talk to the workers about, man, this thing is so hot, they make us work overtime, they don't train us on the job. In other words, you hear all the different points of view. As a filmmaker, I'm used to taking kind of a position in a way, in a subtle way. This one, I felt like we realized we were on the inside of basically, like, in our own little town, in our own little factory of like 2,000 workers, of globalization, of what was going on globally with, you know, foreign investment in blue-collar America. What does that look like? And I think we felt for this film that we really should honor the access and the fact that we could talk to everybody, honor that access by listening to everybody and really balancing their points of view and making sure as an audience you understand everybody's point of view. That's a departure for me. And we were definitely filming as it was happening. And I think another thing that's tough, and I don't know if you guys feel this, is if you're on the inside of a huge global process, it's very difficult to stand outside of that and say, this is where it's going and this is what it all means. We felt, rightly or wrongly, that the best thing to do was to kind of present to the audience, I don't know if you've seen American Factory yet, but this is the complexity that we faced. And it's hard to evaluate which way it's going and who's right and who's wrong. So that was at least part of our challenge in making this film, which is 25, the location of the factory is 25 minutes from our house. We could drive there every day, set up our cameras and go on in, and just wade in and see what was going on and try to follow. It was like following a runaway train, really, wouldn't you say? Yeah, so I'm looking down to Steve there. But I want to definitely hear from Nanfu because you have to go. Yeah.
So tell us what, because you've made two films now.
Three. It's interesting. Two of them about China. One of them is about America. And to your question, the one about America is about America's homelessness and mental illness. And that one did not get even 1 cent of funding. It was probably like the subject matter itself is lack of funding for those two subjects.
But the two films you made about your country got American
distribution.
Yeah.
But I also have interesting experience making the films about China. One was with the first film, Hooligan Sparrow. They were distributed. So my perspective is more about China's influence in America. To a certain extent, I think because of the growing economy and how a lot of corporation companies and people outside of China wanted to have business with China and wanted to have the market. So I've seen the kind of self-censorship that was really alarming to me from people who are in the corporate level or individuals. So there were distributors, I remember during Hooligan Sparrow, told us that they wanted, like, they couldn't distribute the film because they are entering into China. And then when I was making One Child Nation, luckily this one, Amazon distributed it, and it was a difficult subject, it was politically sensitive. But when I was making it, part of the story is about adoptees from China who are adopted in American families. And we've interviewed a bunch of American families. And at some point, they told us, sorry, I can't be in this film because we cannot participate in any films that's critical about the Chinese government. We don't want to lose the access to go to China. We don't want to face the retaliation from China. And that's something that really surprised me because I understood the kind of censorship and self-censorship within China, people, the fear that they have for the government, but I've never seen it. The influence of China is so far-reaching that it could actually make people outside of China self-censor.
Have you had to deal with any retaliation in China or from China?
Yeah, for myself, absolutely. When I was making Hooligan Sparrow, I was interrogated by the national security agents for 5 hours, and they had to take my family, my friends, my college roommates, all to interrogation. And then they constantly, when the film was shortlisted for the Oscar, the government really freaked out. They started to exert all the influence they could to try to silence me. They would ask my family to tell me they had been monitoring what I say in media in conversations outside China. And I had a friend who worked for the central government, and luckily she was a friend, but her job, she told me, was she had a list of people that she's monitoring. She knows English, she studied outside at NYU, and then she returned. Her job is having the list of names and compile in the media what these people say in the media and then translate back to report to her supervisor. And I was on that list.
Where do you live now? Do you live in China or do you live here in the U.S.? Where do you live?
I live in New York.
You live in New York.
Yeah.
And do you think you could live in China now after making these two films?
It's tricky to go back, especially right after I make a film. So for Hooligan Sparrow, I didn't go back for 2 years until I made a film about Americans' homelessness. Then they invited me back to show that film. And then with this One Child Nation, I'm not going back immediately. I figure I need to make another film that shows how bad America is. Then I would be allowed to go in.
That's great.
I don't know what ideas you could come up with while you're here.
A lot, probably.
Well, I really appreciate the fact that you've hung in there and had the courage to make these films.
Thank you.
And we really enjoyed the first non-American film that you made here when we brought it a couple years ago. And I'm really glad that you're here this week. I hope you enjoy Traverse City and everybody treating you okay?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you.
All right. Do you have to go now?
Yeah. Okay.
All right, so let's hear it for Nan.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Interlochen Public Radio, and you're listening to a panel discussion from the Traverse City Film Festival.
It's very interesting what Nan Fu said about her experience with the distribution and distributors. As you said about the camera as a weapon and the access and all these interesting points, as a filmmaker, when we start working in something, everything we were looking for, as important as the context and the film and the characters, it's also the money in the other way. In my situation, I was a student at Aleppo University. I've never knew how to use a camera or what even camera means. And especially in a very secure country like Syria, just to have a camera and work independent, that's kind of crime. So I started filming in 2011 when the revolution started. I was activist and at the same time trying to document with no title about am I a journalist, am I just an activist, or am I a citizen journalist? So it was all confusing things, and I don't know, I was just like keep filming and filming and filming. The fact that what I was thinking about, it's just this life is too short, especially in a place like Syria, where we lived under bombing, shelling, and a lot of other threatened things. So I just kept filming, and I was expect that every minute will be the last minute. So I was just like, keep filming everything. We've eating, I'm filming. We've going out. There's really an attack on a place or anything. I was just like, keep filming and keep filming without any idea about what I will do with this material. But I know that this is just very important, and this is what they will save all the story of Syria. And in 2016, we were forced to flee out, and I had all my hard drives, and I was very care about them, like as much as I was care about myself and my daughter. I was just wanted to take this footage out, because it means everything for us. It means everything we lost, everything we went through, and it's the only thing can really fight the propaganda outside. And I was lucky enough to take this material out. And at the beginning, I was very desperate about why I will do this. I worked at the news for 1 year and a half, and my small reports were shown by millions of people around, and nothing really changed on the ground. So will documentary now will change something? I was very, like, have this question through the whole process until we showed the film first time. I worked with Edward for 2 years. We were trying to make, like, justice to the material, to my story. And we were lucky enough to have that collaboration and great team around us. And the story is political, and I wanted to be very political. I wanted to tell my story in a way that we've seen it. Maybe the people outside the channels will not accept this, but I said, like, I could have been killed for this. So I will say it as I wanted. I will not think about anything around. And we were lucky to have one American distributor, BBSD, with us from the beginning that, okay, do whatever you want, and we will start to make that happen. BBS distribution with Frontline. BBSD?
Oh, PBS.
Yeah, PBS. Yeah, yeah, right. Sorry.
We've heard of them.
My English with the Arabic is...
Oh, your English is incredible.
So after 2 years of working on this in a very dark place and just like editing and come back to the film again and again, the first screening was at South by Southwest in Austin. And we had no idea about how the reaction will be from people. We knew that people will not see in the film. We had all that questions about people are very tired from the Syrian story. People seeing the Syria story as something very complicated and very difficult. And people really doesn't care. Everyone around the world has their own problem. And just like we've been killed in Syria for 8 years, thousands of people, a lot of refugee, people really doesn't want to hear anything about Syria. And like the story itself is very tough. We have a lot of like blood scenes, people been dying, and same time we have a lot of like joy and love and happiness in the story. So it was mixed between these two. And the first screening, I was just waiting how many people will leave before the film will be ended. And really, I was like very terrified about this is the story for me. I know how important is it, but I don't know how people will react for this. And since that time until now, we've went to many places. A lot of distributors around the world take the film. It's opening in many different places, and people react very well, even with all these challenging. So I know how others feel about their films, and if that really doesn't have budget or distributors or distribution. But I felt this is the opposite. Like, it gives me a lot of hope that people around the world really care. And as a filmmaker, as a subject of the film, as my life itself, I felt that people really very, people really care, people really engaged, people hunger to make an action or to feel that there is something in this world we should stand for. And in every place we go to, and I'm waiting for today, it's a very special place for me, Traverse City, and I've never knew about the city before, so I'm very excited to see this audience, how they will react to the film. But I felt that in all this world, the documentaries and everyone who's here doing a great job, this is something give us hope and give us a lot of strength that we should make more. We need really, people are really hunger for something important, And it's not just about the crazy leaders of this world, but it's all about the people, about us, about all our dreams. And I feel that it's really something very good.
Thank you. Let me pivot my original question into a different question here, because you said something that really struck me. And it's something if I'm invited to speak at a film school or whatever, I would usually not say this, but it's what I believe. I believe it about us as citizens in our country, in a democracy or whatever. But you said that when you escaped, you took care to make sure that you had all the hard drives, and that you said, if I remember your words, you took as much care to protect them and to get them out as you did your own child and yourself, that those hard drives were as important as your lives. That sent a chill down me, but it also reminded me too that, and other people on the stage can speak to this, Rick has risked his life in the filming that he's done. Julia made a film in the early 70s called Growing Up Female, which was, I think, the first and seminal film about women and what we really didn't call feminism at that time, but it was so powerful for me as a, I don't know what grade in high school I was in, but it changed my life. That whole, our slogan of one film can change you, Growing Up Female, change you. But for young people in here to speak out like that or to make a film like that in that time was not something that was appreciated. And I think that to be a documentary filmmaker, if you're gonna make these kinds of films, as Nan, I mean, the risk that she's continues to take, that if you're not willing to take that risk, if you're not willing actually to put your life on the line, and isn't that the sense that we should all have as citizens right now? Is it that bad now to the point where would you risk your life to save this country? Would you risk your own lives to turn this away from the deluge that we are in and are heading more into? That a filmmaker would sit here and say that was so powerful. And I just sat here thinking, you know, first of all, not only I believe you're going to live, but if you maintain this attitude, we are going to see some of the most incredible films from you in the coming years, because you are fearless and you'd be willing to risk your own life for the greater good of what you're trying to do. And I honor you for that, and I thank you for that. And I can't wait to see your next film. So.
I want to just add something. I believe that everyone around the world, if he goes for a really tough situation, you will see something you will never thought that it's inside you. And this is not me, really. This is like thousands of Syrians who did great things. This is thousands of people around the world, in here in the UK, in every place. It just need like a very tough situation, and you will see what you can do, really. You will never thought that you can do something. But
that's our hope. That's right. Yes. And there are those who join the French resistance and those who collaborate. Yeah. And history, life, our world gets better because of those who join the resistance. And the progress we have made as humans, and step by step, inch by inch, has been because of the people willing to do that. You're one of those people. People on the stage are those people. Jeff has no idea what he's in store for in terms of what you're going to face because of what this film says. You are not allowed to say these things, and you are not allowed to rip off the mask and show the corporate control and takeover of our green movement. We don't want to hear that. And especially the people who fund it don't want to hear it. And they will do everything, I guarantee you, from my experience, to stop you. So I'm sorry to wreck your morning, but such a nice night last night, I know. But Rick?
Michael, I think the question you started out with about the sort of the hegemony of this one kind of filmmaking that's a personal story of one person who goes back and is allowed to revisit, like that I think that that is the corporate takeover of the kind of radical filmmaking that you were, that Julia, that Joan, that Michael, Steve, that you guys were doing. That the success that you built has made the market react and take over what they call the social issue documentary. And the only, or the way that that system tries to get you to speak, tries to tell you that the only way you can speak is from your very isolated, individual, personal, bourgeois, subjective position, and that's the only spot you have. I mean, just in, we, Jackie and I, we spent 10 years covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We made a whole lot of short films there that were from the perspective of Iraqis, Afghans, you know, in Lebanon during the war in 2006, and none of them punched through. And what we finally did was we tried to use that framework. We used Jeremy as a character, an individual character who went on a journey and traveled through this, an American who like took you through, and we used the narrative tool that that allowed us to penetrate this market and like make a thing that would sort of punch through. But I mean, we, you know, when we started out, we told ourselves that we would never make a film that said the word I, that the only pronoun we would ever use is we. We rejected any reduction of this massive collective movement of history into an individual bourgeois subject, and we made films that worked in their space, right? But this is the terrain we're in. You know, and I mean, and Michael, you created it, right? You were the person who went back and revisited their town, like the town that they grew up in, and made sense of it all. But you made sense of it in a way that that opened it up, that didn't shrink it down into an individual subjective personal experience that was only your own. It opened it up and made it a big collective experience of everyone in America. I mean, I think that's the... that's the cultural struggle we have right now in the documentary filmmaking world, is that that form, right, that just the surface of that form is something that everyone is copying and that is very commercially successful now, with none of the content and none of the kind of none of the reach.
Can we up here? Can we explain a little? Can we go a little deeper into what we know? We know the code. We know what he's saying here, and there is a documentary culture that has kind of been established, and there are institutions, foundations, not so much distributors, but a little bit of that, that if you want to get your money, you have to, what's that new thing now, that not the action plan or the...
the impact and engagement strategy?
Impact. What is your impact and engagement strategy? Now, that sounds like a good thing to be concerned about. It's because we all want our films to have impact. But I have noticed I don't know what to say. I don't know how to, you know, maybe nobody wants to get into this because these are the people that fund your films. But I don't know if I like where things have headed here. And who's got the courage to... say, I can say it because I don't need any of that system. But so if you want me to say it, I'll say it. But I'd like to see if anybody else up here would be willing to say it.
I like to play contrarian a little bit. It's a lot to give a filmmaker $1 million or $750,000 to make a film for which there's very little chance of a return. So, in defense of the funders of our documentaries. Two sets of filmmakers up here are funded by the same organization, Participant Media, which is an organization that is generally about social change, I would say. They don't have a high expectation of making their money back. They fund a number of wonderful films that you've probably heard of and seen. It is hard to get someone to fund a film for which there isn't a clear both return on investment but also impact. And documentaries have not very measurable sort of impact. So it is an act of faith. That said, I completely agree with the sentiment up here. It's very hard to get funding for films that take on social issues directly. What's genius about the work that Michael does is that it punches through because it entertains at the same time it informs and changes people's mind. But that's a very hard trick to pull off. Michael's unique in that way. A lot of our films are not immediately accessible, or they are, but they're not, they don't seem, they're not, you know, if you put them on a marquee, people are not going to line up to see them necessarily. So it's difficult. I have empathy for the folks who fund our films. It's really an audience issue as much as anything else. We need audiences to, I think the American audience, you know, generally wants their entertainment spoon-fed to them in a certain way. They this audience notwithstanding, people are resistant to serious documentaries. There's a thing that they have to get over to go see them, and Free Solo and Mr. Rogers are much more accessible in that way. So I do think it's a problem of funding. I also think it's a problem of sort of our entertainment culture in general, and documentary finding their place in that,
Barrick,
in that landscape.
So you say the word entertainment like, you know, sort of a kind of a dirty word. And this is the thing I've tried for years. I thought after Roger Me, there'd be 100 films that would just go for it. And I was shocked that there weren't. I mean, I didn't start out saying I'm going to make an entertaining film. I just thought that, well, it's like Jeff and I, we've been putting together all the rules for documentary filmmaking. And rule number one is don't make a documentary, make a movie. If you want an audience to see it, you should make it as what it, honor the form you're using. You're making a film. Make a movie. Make a movie that's, and the entertaining, I don't know, is Schindler's List entertaining? It's one of the most popular, highest box office films. Sophie's Choice, there's an entertainment film for you. You know, I mean, but yet, if you want to use the word broadly in the sense that, could I not get out of my seat because I hadn't read the book at the end of Sophie's Choice in that theater because I was so devastated by it? That is when entertainment, when movies do their real job. It's not just, you know, silly stuff or goofy stuff or, you know, comedy.
But movies are with one protagonist so often. And what I think what you were speaking to is funders want you to choose one of your protagonists. And yet social change, the world gets better when we organize, when we get together as a group. And like some of us try to make movies about many protagonists, and the funders come to us and say, no, that one over there, make that one your lead character. Everyone else can be a supporting character. And there's this tension between, and as Barrick was saying, it's like the funders want the films to reach the widest audience. Stories with one protagonist go further, just, you know, statistically. And there's always this push-pull, right? But I think what we can do, if we have a situation where multiple, like a struggle of a community can be the community can be the protagonist, it still has to be a movie, it still has to be entertaining and forceful as a story, but I don't think we should ever say, like, just pick one.
I feel character. If I made Roger Me now, in the system that is grown up around funding documentaries, I would be told, focus on that bunny lady. Just follow the bunny lady all the way through the film, you know? And
that would be a great film. I mean, you know.
I
would fund that. Totally.
But I when there's multiple characters, how many films, documentaries have we seen where they follow five people through the competition of the National Science Fair or the Spelling Bee or whatever? And we're not really being honest with the audience, not I'm saying me in that, but how did the filmmaker know that these five were out of the literally millions of kids participating in spelling bees across the country were going to end up in the national championship? And the public doesn't, they think the camera was there at the beginning. The filmmaker's gone back after they've been in it to film it, and not mention that the subject that they're talking to already knows they've already been to the national whatever. I don't mean to pick on the Spelling Bee film. I don't even know if that's the case. But I'm just saying we know as filmmakers the tricks here they're being used. And then it's so inauthentic at that point. And I just, what you said, Steve, I don't know. I think even like if you did the multiple characters, they're like, you know, yes, you've picked your five. Now let's see which one will lose their job at the Dayton factory and which one will go on to become the chairman of the board or whatever. It's just so, I mm-hmm. you know, which I'll pivot to the next part of this.
Can I just jump in for a second? Yeah. Because you've raised so many issues. I don't even know where to begin, but I want to go back to where you were talking about making these films in a timely manner, and you know, so much of what we do requires funding. It takes a long time. By the time the film is finished, it's about the past. And I think what Wad was doing is that she was sending her material out as it was happening, and it was seen by millions, and it had a tremendous effect. And what we have to do now is we have to make a film that's entertaining, that's positive, that people want to see, that wraps it all up in three acts. And by the time the film's finished and people actually see it, it's something that happened way in the past. And I think that this is why things like Vice or, you know, people that are putting their material out as it's happening is so important. And that's, you know, why we make documentaries, to try to show the world what's
urgency
happening, yeah, right, as it's happening. Yeah. So we're stuck in this paradigm that prevents that.
I was just thinking about the first thing that you brought up, and I'm very sleep deprived. We finished our film at 4 in the morning before the screening. I think that's when we wrap things up, right? One of the things with Planet of the Humans, it's been a struggle, I think, conceptually, and it's a struggle for funding, and it's a struggle, is to take the perspective outside of where we're at as a culture or a civilization or a species. And as daunting as that is, I think that's, these things are connecting in ways that we don't understand. I think there's specific reasons for what's happening in Syria, in Iraq, and you know, all around the world. And you know, when pirates are roaming the seas off the Somalian coast because they're out of fish, because we've consumed all the fish in the ocean, because we have giant industrial fish trawlers scraping the bottom of the sea for our own food, for the sushi bar, for our cat food, for our dog food, for more food to put into the salmon farms to grow fish, that we don't even realize we're out of fish. And so we're in this time when we're really lacking perspective, and that includes me. And it's because it's really hard when you go into therapy, recovery, marital issues, to step outside and really see ourselves for who we are. And I think that's a challenge. And for me, what you said about the difficulty getting distributors and funding and the happy films, we have these films out like this amazing, was it the Planet Earth series? It's all this wonderful footage that then they slip in the message, oh, by the way, all these animals are dying, they're in trouble, but they just spent 2 hours showing you how beautiful it is, and that's a lie. That is a lie. It's the truth, it's a lie. But we're part of that lie, because I think things have evolved where, you know, as things get more stressed, and I really believe we're in the time we're approaching civilizational collapse. I hate to say that. That is in our near future. And we all get crazier, not just the right, but we do too. And I think we've been avoiding the darker stories. We've been avoiding looking at the big picture. And so this is a co-created world we live in which we've fallen for illusions ourselves. It's easy to see the other side believing, oh, we're going to find more oil, you know, we're going to have more magic, this and that. But our own magical thinking is very hard to discover. So I don't know what that all means, but when we see Trump and then these other right-wing people being elected, when we see the desire for only positive, happy stories, you've got to think positive, right? Where's your solutions? This is what happens when civilizations begin to unravel. We all live in more fantasies. And I think the trick for us is, can we look at ourselves and wake ourselves up and collectively begin to bring, you know, the only hope is reality therapy. On the other side, there's some relief and joy, even if we know that we're kind of doomed and screwed. Once we understand the true state of the war that we're in and what's happening, there's a kind of freedom that occurs. And I think what we're doing is so important, and for us to actually step it up and begin to realize that everything that's happening is connected. And we're a global civilization. Civilizations last, one person interview told me 30 years. How long did the Soviet Union last? Decades, not centuries. You know, we don't realize that we're in this large story that connects all of the things that we're all working on here. And I hope there's more of a chance in the future where we can spend some time. I don't know what it would look like, a think tank or something, but there's not even a mechanism for us to all get together and connect these pieces. It doesn't exist in the environmental movement. Where is the planning for what's happening with the totality of humans on this planet? We're trying to solve climate change, great. But that discussion doesn't even exist. And so, I don't know what we're going to do, but it really is truly up to people that come from the harsh places where people are dying and suffering and working themselves to death. We've got to be the resistance, because nobody else is going to do it. And the billionaires and bankers are not going to fund the films that are going to change the world. We got to do it. So find our own way. So anyways, that's my...
I want to just thank you for this, because it's really what we need all to do. Just focus on what we want to, what's our story and what we want to focus on without any other, caring about where's the money and how we can get it or whatever. And just part of what we went, when we were doing for SAMA, we moved for Ed's place. He lives in church. He's making gardener for church. So we moved to the church and we stayed editing there for more than 5 months with no money, with nothing. And we were just in darker place, and the church is gonna fall. It needs $6 million to recover the church. So it doesn't matter. We left the place where we were editing. We stayed there for 5 months, just focusing on the story as we wanted to be, and just forget about everything. We knew at that moment that maybe no one will see the film. We wasn't even care that if the story will be ended or is that when we will make the film, our executive producer and other people will say, yeah, go for this. We had no idea about what the film will be at the end. But we just were, okay, we believe in this. We need to tell the story as this. And now it's out. It's out, and everyone around the world wants not just to see, but to buy the film. And just something... People, when they feel that this is a true story, this is something close, this is something we should care about, and it's affected our life and our future, people will be really care about that. So just thank you for your...
Thank you. Civilizations really and societies do not survive unless people risk their lives and everything they have to do something.
I want to thank Rick and Barrick and Julia, Joan, Wad, Steve, and Jeff for this panel. Go see their films here this week. Thank you for being here. Enjoy the Traverse City Film Festival.
You've been listening to a panel discussion from the 2019 Traverse City Film Festival. You can listen to this panel and others at interlochandpublicradio.org. Thanks to Sam Olivares from Blue Water Technologies. I'm Linnea Melkarek. Thanks for listening.